Few films have captured the epic sweep and personal drama of lives caught up in moments of historic upheaval quite like Gone with the Wind. Often topping the list of most beloved films of all time, Gone with the Wind remains an essential pillar of the cinema, and the story of its making is as epic as the film itself. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. Gone with the Wind celebrated its 75th anniversary last year. A new exhibition at the El Paso Museum of History about the making of this cinema classic includes production documents, drawings, and artifacts from the film on loan from the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. I spoke to Steve Wilson, author of the book The Making of Gone with the Wind and curator of both the exhibition and the film collection at the Harry Ransom Center last year. The following is a re-airing of our conversation from October of 2014. It's great to have you back on the program. This is something I know has been in the works for literally years.
Yeah, as it turns out.
So congratulations on
an
amazing book. It's a hefty tome befitting the epicness of the movie that you're chronicling. You are both the author and the curator of the companion exhibit that goes with this, or the book is the companion to the exhibit. They go in tandem.
Yes.
Describe for us the exhibition.
Well, it tells the story of the making of Gone with the Wind from the very first teletype that Kay Brown sent to David Selznick. And it goes through the casting of Scarlett, this nationwide search for a new personality to play Scarlett O'Hara, through various protests and design process with William Cameron Menzies and Lyle Wheeler, and the writing of the screenplay and the deal with MGM, all the way through the actual filming of the production and George Cukor leaving and Victor Fleming coming on and Victor Fleming collapsing, and all the way to the three-day premiere in Atlanta. So it's a big story.
I mentioned at the beginning of my intro that this Gone with the Wind is at the top of many people's most beloved films of all time list, but it's also on a few people's most reviled lists.
That's right.
This is one of those films that, at least on the surface, if you know the story, if you've never seen the film, which is hard to imagine, but there are still lots of people and new generations that have not been exposed to this film. But this is a film that takes place during the Civil War, and it's told from a Southern perspective, and it has characters that are unrepentantly Southern.
Right.
They're slave owners. There's horrible things that happen in the film. It's not on its surface today an obvious candidate for one of those films that persists decade after decade after decade.
That's right. I think that's part of the appeal, too, in a way, that Scarlett is, the main character, Scarlett O'Hara, is both magnetic and kind of repulsive in a way, too. I mean, she's not an entirely likable character, and yet you find yourself drawn to her.
Is that because she's a survivor? There's a part of her spirit that we can all relate to?
Well, I think that's what, especially during the Great Depression, I think that was something that really resonated with people. She did what she had to protect her family and protect her home and herself. But she also made some very bad choices as well.
Yeah.
Not just in love, but also she runs the lumber mill with convict labor and things like that. You know, she just makes some really dubious choices at times.
It is one of those rare characters that you find yourself both rooting for and waiting for their comeuppance.
Right. Exactly.
And how that film manages to tiptoe along that edge for almost 4 hours is part of, I think, the marvel of Gone with the Wind.
Right. Well, and it's also, you know, depicting a period. I mean, it's set during the Civil War, but I've been saying that I think that Gone with the Wind is really more about the Great Depression. The themes, the things that Scarlett has to deal with, you know, hunger, for example, was something that people during the Great Depression touched just about everybody's lives. The hardships of war. World War I was a very recent memory for people then, and everyone knew what was about to happen in Europe. And then there's the connection to the land, you know, terra, terra, terra. That was something, you know, the migration to the suburbs was something that was already happening. It would increase after World War II, but it was already happening during the Depression. I think all these things together were things that Scarlett was was dealing with, but that the general public in America especially was dealing with as well.
And, of course, it comes on the heels of the publication of Margaret Mitchell's extremely popular novel,
right,
which is some 1,000 pages or so, that David O. Selznick got under contract. But
well, that was something that I found very interesting as we did the research for this. I hadn't realized before, but the announcement that Selznick had purchased the rights to the novel, that announcement happened at about the same time, within just a couple of days, of the book being available to the public. And consequently, everyone who was reading the novel knew that David O. Selznick, of mm-hmm. all people, was about to make a film. And so there started this incredible parlor game, they called it, at the time, of guessing who was going to play Scarlet and Rhett and all of those. And it just became a national obsession.
You know, it seems from afar, you know, we're now 75 years past its making, and for all the reasons you've illuminated why it was such a popular film in its time, but it has persevered for 75 years, and it's hard for me to put myself back in 1939.
Right.
Your book certainly helps me do that, but it's now such an indelible part of our film and popular culture that we might forget that there was a time when it still had to be made.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And before it became a pillar of the cinema, you know, we often think of these things as preordained artistic successes, but you know, one of the things I love about the book, and I imagine, you know, since the book chronicles the exhibition, is that you really get this sense of these great works not being sure things.
That's right. That's right. Well, at the very beginning, Selznick was not enthusiastic about the story because he felt that Civil War stories were not going to sell.
Mm-hmm. Period pieces.
Right. And then he was then he became concerned about who he was going to cast, and he decided, since the book was such an immediate bestseller, that he would try to get a new girl to play Scarlet. That way, you know, he was trying to build his own studio.
Right.
Well, whoever played the part of Scarlet would be an instant star, and he wanted that star to be under contract to him.
But wouldn't he also be thinking that they don't come with the baggage in the public mind? They can
True.
Fully accept her as Scarlet.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he went to a lot of trouble to try to find this new person. Now, he did a nationwide search. Well, he started with a tour through the South doing open casting calls, and he thought that maybe he would find someone there and also get some publicity. Pretty soon, they decided that the best thing to do was to focus on universities and little theater groups, and they did find some people there. But what they ran across was that people were wrapped up in the whole Gone with the Wind phenomenon, and a lot of these young women wanted to be in Gone with the Wind but did not otherwise want a movie career. And that was a big problem for Selznick. He was looking for a new star. So, but that was something that he ran across over and over again, was this incredible phenomenon of Gone with the Wind, the book, and people knowing that the movie was coming, and they wanted to be involved in this process somehow. So when they did these open casting calls, the three talent scouts who were holding these open casting calls, you know, they thought maybe 100 people would show up, but 500 would show up. They would be just completely overwhelmed. Women would show up in hoop skirts and bring babies to be considered for the baby parts. It was just turned into a circus, but people were trying to be part of the story.
It was certainly a high wire act, and you get that sense reading a lot of the reproduced documents and memos mm-hmm. in your book that are flying back and forth over the several years of pre-production, that the expectation was like, really, there's not an analog, I think, in today's world of...
Right.
Maybe the coming Star Wars film.
Right, maybe so, yeah.
But David O. Selznick, and we're not used to these kinds of figures like David O. Selznick, who is controlling every
right.
single aspect of this production.
Mm-hmm. During this entire 3-year period, he always thought he was about to start shooting.
Yeah.
He always thought he was just a couple of months away, and he just needed some things to fall together. And at one point, he told his publicity people to stop publicizing it because he was afraid the public would get tired of the story, but they never did. And it was just all the way up through the filming of the movie, people were just enraptured about the story, about making this movie.
But his peers thought this would be his undoing.
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of people thought that it was just going to fail, especially Warner Brothers. I think he really had some problems with Harry Warner, and the production of Jezebel really got under his skin. But, you know, the story was close to Gone with the Wind, and Bette Davis really wanted to play Scarlett, but she was under contract to Warner Brothers, not Selznick.
As you watch visitors experience the exhibition there at the Harry Ransom Center, are there particular items you find they gravitate to?
The dresses.
The gowns.
We're having a bit of a problem with people trying to touch the dresses, especially the curtain dress. There's something about it. It really does have a presence in person. That particular dress, it kind of represents Scarlett's, you know, tenacity and resourcefulness and survival instinct. And then also people remember the Carol Burnett sketch with the,
of course,
curtain rod, which I get a kick out of because, I mean, what other film costume is worthy of being parodied like that, you know? We have three originals and two replicas on display, and people just really gravitate towards those. And then they move on to the rest of the exhibition and see the concept paintings and the documents and fan mail. We have a lot of the letters from the public on various subjects. One of my favorites is, we call it the I Am Scarlett, women writing in asking to be considered for the part of Scarlett O'Hara. Selznick let it be known through fan magazines and newspaper articles and gossip columns that anybody could ask to be considered for the part of Scarlett, and lots of people did. And a lot of these women who wrote in to be considered for Scarlett identified with the character so strongly that they would actually say in the letter, "I am Scarlett." But a lot of times they were just writing in, just shot in the dark, trying to be part of the story, I think.
Well, I know you've lived with these artifacts, papers and drawings and paintings and costumes for years, and a film like Gone with the Wind is really too epic for us to do in one show. So I'm wondering if you can hold over and we can discuss more of the making of Gone with the Wind next week.
I'd be very happy to.
Fantastic. You've been listening to a re-airing of my 2014 conversation about the book The Making of Gone with the Wind with author Steve Wilson, curator of the film collection at the Harry Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. Gone with the Wind recently screened at the Plaza Classic Film Festival, and its subject is an ongoing exhibition at the El Paso Museum of History titled Frankly, My Dear, The Art and Impact of Gone with the Wind, open now through September 6th. We'll re-air part two of my 2014 conversation with Steve Wilson about the making of Gone with the Wind next week. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.